I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. We're going to start this week by analyzing a new scientific study. I'm not joking, but I promise it'll be fun. I'm joined by Michael Lee of The Athletic and by Nora Princiati of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to you both.
Thanks to be here.
Thank you, Karen.
So I don't normally follow the latest research out of the Aspen Institute, but this week our friend Patrick Ruby tweeted out an interesting report. They studied the dangers and benefits of high school sports. And no surprise, football was ranked the very worst for causing injuries. But it was also ranked number two for what they called psychosocial benefits. And football would have been ranked number one for psychosocial benefits if not for the fact that football players are also more likely to engage in risky behaviors like excessive drinking. But that to me seems like a self-selecting kind of thing. Like kids who are going to be attracted to risky behaviors are also going to be attracted to the risky sport of football. So this really sums up to me the issue that we've been grappling with for about the past decade, which is there a way to make football less dangerous without turning off the kids that need it the most? And those are the kids who are attracted to the dangers of football. And I'm all questions and no answers. So, Nora, what do you think?
So, first of all, my perspective on football is that kids don't need to play it in high school. High school football scares me, frankly, just because all the research shows that when your brain is younger, that's when it's the most vulnerable. And the thing that I thought looking at the study was just that the psychosocial benefits seemed more related to playing a team sport than playing football specifically. So even as a football writer, I looked at it and thought, well, yeah, that's great, but don't you think it's maybe just being outside and being on a team and making friends?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have an issue with high school football as much as I do like Pop Warner, like really little kids. But I think that, you know, at a high school level, you know, that's kind of like those awkward years where you're trying to find yourself. The teams are usually pretty big. And so you're a part of a really large community and you have the whole town behind you. You know, I know from my years from covering high school football, I know just what that sport can do to just bring people together and to also raise that self-esteem of the athletes that perform, because you got 11 guys sort of on the field as one. If you play high school basketball, the gym may be empty. If you play cross country, for sure, you're really by yourself because there's no one there to cheer you, even when you cross the finish line. And I know that from running cross country in high school. But football, I can totally understand why it's viewed positively by the participants. That doesn't make it any less dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up youth football, and certainly the solution there has been to suggest that kids under 14 just play flag football instead, that they don't really need to tackle.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah, and I'm totally
so
in
Brett
favor
Favre
of that.
And,
yeah. And, you know, Tom Brady and the Mannings, none of them played tackle football until they were a little bit older. But what was interesting to me in this study, because I have thought, hey, what if we just made high school football, flag football? Like, would the community still show up? Would you still get those 100 kids who are all working towards the same thing? And this study really made me question my own sort of point of view on that, because then I wonder, these kids who are looking for a risky behavior, I'm not sure they're going to find it in flag football. So it's a problem. There's definitely more work to do. Michael, basketball. We need some basketball. Help us out here.
We have our latest effort to fix an issue for college basketball that avoids the obvious solution, paying the players. You see that the G League is now offering an alternative to the NCAA's one-and-done rule by providing the ultimate incentive to have elite prospects from high school, 18 years old, who aren't eligible for the draft, to come and play for $125,000 a year, which is a lot of money, especially when you consider that this is more than the max salary for a WNBA player. And that's another topic that we can discuss later. But the best part about these select contracts that the G League is going to offer is that the players are able to sell their likeness. They're able to sign with an agent. But there is a risk to this. One being, you're playing in the G League. So you're playing with grown men. So you may not be able to establish yourself or separate yourself from a skill perspective, as you would say in college when you're playing against guys your own age. Also, the G League does not provide the platform that a billion-dollar industry like the NCAA will. While I applaud the G League for trying to provide an alternative, I think that the NCAA could actually benefit their athletes, and especially the elite basketball players, by just allowing them to have the ability to hire an agent to sell their likeness and to sign shoe deals. I think that could resolve the issue of paying the players. I just wonder, can the NCAA ever just step up and just solve its own problem?
Well, so I would say that no, I have absolutely no confidence in the NCAA just sort of one day waking up and deciding like, oh, we're going to do the right thing here. Cool. That said, probably the best possible outcome from this, right, or at least as I see it, would be that the threat of elite high school players going to the G League instead of being one and dones would be enough to push the NCAA to reform. They're not going to do it on their own because they just feel like it. I mean, I think the only way it works, and this seems like an uphill battle, is if the G League alternative is a good enough one that it can actually be a source of real pressure on the NCAA, which would be the first time that there's an alternative that's been able to do that, right?
If guys were actually getting drafted out of the G League into those top spots, then I think it could work. But Michael, you promised that we could talk about the WNBA issue, so I'm going to hold you to that. WNBA players get paid less than these top high schoolers would. I didn't immediately make that connection, like, hey, this is really proof that something is a little off here. Exactly. And it really shows how ingrained this idea is that male athletes should always get paid more than female athletes. And no one is suggesting that WNBA players should get paid as much as NBA players.
No.
But I do, you know, Sue Bird has said that there's a bias that exists here. And I really think the idea of minor league players in a league that hasn't even, like, they're not even on
TV. They're not on ESPN.
Right?
On TV. Yeah.
And the fact that they would make
more. The
Big
Three has a better television deal in the G League.
Right. I mean, if we need a stronger indication that there is a bias, I don't think we'd find one.
Amen. I totally agree. I think it's really unfair. Diana Taurasi is my favorite basketball player, like male or female. Like, I love seeing her play. And then you have this deal that's sort of like a slap in the face to sort of remind you that, yeah, in this country, we reward male athletes much more significantly than we do females.
Well, the percentage of total revenue that goes to player salaries in the WNBA is significantly lower.
20 to 25%.
Right, exactly. And in the NBA, 50%. It's 50.
Instead of 50%.
So as is only a game tradition, we save our most important topic for last. Nora, do you?
Yeah, I think this is going to mark the end of my tenure as a Boston Globe Patriots reporter, because I'm sure that I am just days from a call-up to the Spotlight investigative team. I wrote a piece recently about touchdown and big play celebrations, and it was kind of it's something that the NFL has been letting players do a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I love when guys get really creative about it. I went around and did a little digging in the Patriots locker room and pulled a bunch of guys to come up with kind of a grading system for how to look at a celebration and decide if it's up to snuff. And I have a confession for you guys, because what all the Patriots players said was that you just can't celebrate when you're losing. And this had actually happened. The Colts got an interception a couple weeks ago in a game, and they were down by 2 scores. And they start celebrating and, like, doing this dance. They're, you know, close to the end zone. The cameras got them. And obviously on TV, you see the score right below. And you're like, ooh, guys, rough. And I'm going around and they're all saying, well, you can't celebrate when you're losing. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, and this is why I'm not a professional athlete, but can't you?
Well, it depends on how much you're losing by.
Right. But I just believe in everybody's right to hype themselves.
I support that as well. And, like, if you pick off Tom Brady, you should, you know, let everybody know. Yeah, I picked off Tom Brady. Watch me stomp. Yeah. But if you're getting your butt kicked, you just look kind of silly.
I love all of these. You know, it's so funny. The NFL and football traditionalists stood in the way of this for so long. And they were like, football is a team sport. It's not about the individual. And, like, celebration is unseemly. And meanwhile, we get these celebrations that are, like, joyous and fun, and they include teamwork, and they are so much more interesting than what was allowed before, which was basically like a grunt in the end zone that made these guys look like Neanderthals. I mean, like, you see, like, creativity and all these wonderful things.
It's cool, but I like the rogue element of it being forbidden. Like, I liked it when Terrell Owens, like, you know,
hiding,
grabbed the pom-poms.
Hiding the Sharpie in
and
the,
like,
sock.
Yeah, the Sharpie in the sock. Like, that's legendary. Like, for me, now that everybody is sort of, you know, encouraged to celebrate, it's gotten a little corny. I'm like, you spent a whole week thinking of this one, you know? So I judge them much more harshly now that they're kind of given the permission to do it.
By my own admission, I'm a very corny person, so I'm
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Athletic's Michael Lee and The Boston Globe's Nora Princiotti. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Absolutely, Karen.